Welcome back to the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of December 1st, 2025. Tom, where did you want to start?
All right, we're going to kick it off with an article from SecureList. It's titled, Blockchain and Node.js Abused by Sunder, an Emerging Botnet. So the Sunder botnet is a newly discovered, actively expanding botnet. It was first observed roughly mid this year, a little past mid this year. Sunder represents a significant evolution in botnet design because instead of like static C2 infrastructure, it's leveraging Ethereum blockchain via smart contract to store and dynamically rotate the command and control server addresses, really increasing that resilience and making traditional takedown much harder. So the distribution mechanisms include a fake MSI installer masquerading as, popular game installers. So think things like Valorant, Counter-Strike, Rainbow Six, things like that, as well as a PowerShell-based dropper. It also has a PowerShell-based dropper. I'm all right, Scott, I promise. Sunder also leverages previous supply chain abuse via malicious typo-squatted Node.js NPM packages. Once installed, the bot establishes a persistent runtime using Node.js. It pulls legitimate dependencies, so things like WebSocket, Ethereum Library, Process Manager, and so on. And it connects via WebSocket to its C2 to receive and execute arbitrary JavaScript dynamically, allowing flexible malicious payloads on demand. So this it's kind of C2 on steroids a bit. The attribution, the cluster behind Sunder is likely Russian-speaking. The same actor, they go by the alias of Kaniko, is linked to other malware products, a stealer that's sold under a similar but separate name, as well as some of the language and also the avoidance of the CIS regions, suggests that this is kind of where the attribution should lie. So I'll just kind of talk through some of the technical stuff. There was a lot of depth in this one, Scott. So if I miss anything, please fill any gaps that I might skip over. So the MSI installer, it's disguised as a popular, game, like I had mentioned. It installs a full Node.js runtime in appdata local / Node.js. So this is particularly interesting because Node generally doesn't install there unless you're doing it for a purpose, but you're not going to see it under that appdata local typically. So it's a bit of a low signal for suspicion. And it drops along with it some obfuscated JavaScript files. And then a custom action triggers a hidden PowerShell command that then launches the Node.js executable to spawn that malicious loader. So the PowerShell infector variant does pretty much pretty similar things, downloads that Node.js, usually pulls it from a zip from Node.js.org, extracts it to the same directory, then decrypts the embedded JavaScripts, writes a package .json, and then installs the dependency. So just does a little more manual moving. But the one thing to note with the PowerShell variant is that it does, through its automation process, it does establish persistence via the run register keys. And then, after setup, dependencies installed via NPM, that WebSocket, your Ethereum library, and then the Node.js process manager, those are all set up. And then the bot retrieves its current WebSocket C2 server address from a smart contract that's deployed on the Ethereum blockchain. So this is where I think it gets the most interesting. I'm very fascinated by the pivot to blockchain for C2. The contractors state holds the address, and then when the attacker wants to rotate that C2, they simply just update the contract, and then the bots query those public RPC endpoints to read that contract state and then extract that current C2 URL. This is pretty similar to a couple things we've talked about in the previous shows over the last couple months, but definitely an uptick in the blockchain being used. It is very interesting to me. So after obtaining that C2 URL, the bot ensures it's valid. It does, it checks the system locale, really trying to stay away from the CIS regions. And then it'll establish its socket. And then the communication, once connected, the bot and the server exchange an AES key. And then they use encrypted WebSocket messaging. The bot sends system info, so things like the OS, the MAC address, memory information, GPU information, and so on. And then it receives a JSON response acknowledging the presence of what how it's been established. This is important for something I'm going to get to later on. And then it remains connected periodically, doing a bit of a ping pong messages to make sure that the session's still intact. So part of the payload execution and flexibility of this thing, the bot supports dynamic execution of arbitrary JavaScript code. So when the C2 sends a message, the bot interprets it as code, executes it, returns the result, enabling very, very flexible on-the-fly deployment of tasks. Again, this is something that's going to keep stacking towards a later point. Because of this design, the operator really can adapt that behavior. Data theft, proxying, multiplexing, custom payloads, all kinds of stuff can be accomplished with this thing. The threat actor, so some of the ecosystem and then the model this is built on, this is where it gets even more interesting. The threat actor actually operates a web-based control panel, and it's open for registration. So you can people can go out and they can, you know, partake in this and sign up and deploy and manage bots, even build your own bots within the platform to leverage. The panel includes a marketplace. So like I said, users can build those bots, configure them, and then also resell or lease them to other actors. So features in this include selling bot services, deploying bots as proxies or SOCs, offering custom functionality. Basically, it's a whole malware as a service platform built around this kind of botnet framework. Each build gets a unique ID and embedded in the implant, and it's sent to the C2 when infection occurs. Then it enables tracking and attribution for the purchaser, which is really wild to me. It's like a full-on business model, Scott, full-on platform that they've built around this. So, you know, some things just to talk about, because there's a lot there. Again, I went through a ton, but some of the things that I kind of picked out from like a hunt kind of, you know, looking to see if you can track this thing down. Those MSI installers, PowerShell scripts that are, you know, kind of out there trying to masquerade, those, you know, things you can look for in that way. MSI files being installed from odd places. This is something I think we've gone over before, Scott. The Node.js under the app data local, that's a signal for suspicion. The use of the PM2 library or other Node process management tools can be leveraged for persistence, especially when launched via registry. So they can find their way to be implanted in those run registry keys. So there's another way that they can leverage persistence via the run registry key. Some network stuff you can look for, right? The web connections out to those RPC nodes. If people frequently querying or routine querying of those public Ethereum RPC endpoints, that's something that could stand out. And then I think the last thing I kind of noted here, Scott, is looking for those kind of suspicious child processes that would spawn from Node or NPM. There are things that Node and NPM will natively spawn in their normal actions. You will see things like command being put up, PowerShell, things like that. They will spawn those, but then it's what happens next that you track with those. But there are other things that are typically not spawned, so you shouldn't see things that a service like this that could generate malware and initiate commands and all those things. So think about things that are kind of outside of that box when you're looking at Node kind of sending curl out to the web to pull additional packaging. You know, maybe it's leveraging some of the lol bins on your machine. Maybe it's launching nmap. There's kind of a whole bucket of stuff that it just doesn't normally do that would stand out. Even if you see Node calling WScript or CScript, MSHTA, you know, if you see it launching PowerShell and PowerShell initiating encoded commands, you see that chain, that's going to stand out as certainly weird for Node. But yeah, that's a lot, Scott. This was a big one. I was fascinated by some of the details in this, so I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I love big write-ups like this because it shows some of the complexity and also some of the avenues a lot of actors will go through, especially like Node.js. It's like a non-traditional way to execute a lot of attacks. So my assumption is either the attacker is really familiar with Node.js, or they are familiarity to know that a lot of EDRs, maybe defense tools, aren't looking at Node.js. So they know there's like a visibility gap, or there's not a lot of detection content or things around it. So I think that's why sometimes you see just some development that goes that way as well. But just like a lot of things, when we see these really complicated attacks that I like seeing, are those initial pieces that we commonly look for that show up even on the more basic type campaigns and attacks? Because as a defender, if you know, I mean, you know, because you've worked with me and worked in this space long enough, but all you need to do is find that one thing that's worth investigating and spend the time to just understand it. And you typically will find these types of attacks with the easy stuff. In this case, is exactly what you were talking about earlier, right? With the PowerShell command, setting the registry run key, which is a no-brainer. Sometimes people don't necessarily monitor that because things in the environment can make that noisy. That's why it's a great threat hunting exercise. But just seeing what's being planted there is the CMD command prompt running the PM2 with the start command, right? Which is that process manager piece of Node.js. But anytime you see CMD/C with like where it's passing a command of something start, that's a kind of a questionable way for programs to start in a lot of ways. And if there is something in your environment that kind of uses that method, it's going to be very static, seen across the board, and something that's easy to exclude once you understand that behavior in your environment. But that is a telltale sign that, well, why or what is that starting? And how did it, and when did it start doing that? You start asking those questions, and as you get those answers, that's when you can start, you know, pivoting through all the other artifacts that they're able to dig out. Because some of this stuff, it really is easy to identify forensically. I just like how there's always these simple lead-ins to these really complex things.
Yeah, for sure. That does seem super complex on the outside. And the stuff with like Node, it seems to be picking up. It seems that, at least from my eyes, maybe it's through all the intel that I'm ingesting, but I'm seeing Node leverage more. We talked about Shai Hulud last week, and they're kind of newer, the newer campaign for that malware. And they, it was leveraging Node in a way to kind of get around those security controls and kind of blend in as, you know, obscure activity. But what it was doing is it was launching, in that case, it was actually leveraging Node and NPM to launch its malicious actions from a pre-install phase. So it was kind of like in this weird flux to where you can't see it. And in leveraging pre-install, I think it, from my research anyway, it's been known to be kind of vulnerable for that. But the one thing that I've kind of stitched together from just these two examples, this one and then that one, is when you see Node doing stuff it shouldn't do, it's just getting familiar with what Node's going to do. A lot of the stuff where I'm seeing where malicious actors are leveraging Node or leveraging NPM in the code, they're prompting a shell somehow in most cases, right? Or they're taking an action where telemetry is going to be automatic. You're going to see this thing doing something, right? So it doesn't need to feel overly complicated to try to find, if you get what I mean. Like, just adding on to what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, I would make the parallel to, you know, finding attacks on Linux isn't necessarily hard either, but you have to be familiar with Linux. So
it's how to be familiar with Linux.
Yeah. Right. So like getting familiar with what attackers are using, either by trying to use it yourself a little bit, playing around, stuff like that, can go a long way. So, yeah.
Yep.
All right.
Cool. What do you got next for us?
So the next one, it's a blog from Group IB titled, scroll to the top of it, Bloody Wolf, a Blunt Crowbar Threat to Justice. And so it's kind of a blog about how there's this APT that they've been tracking, first observed in late 2023. It originally used commercial malware, a tool called Strat, for its type of rat. But then more recently, in the last year or so, they switched to the more legitimate remote access stuff you've been seeing with a lot of ransomware groups, with the administration type tools. And in this case, Net Support Manager. So they call it the Net Support Rat. They've switched kind of their targeting, because they were originally targeting, what was it, Russia and Kazakhstan, but now they're starting to see where their campaign gets Kyrgyzstan and then parts of Central Asia, and Uzbekistan. So it's interesting to kind of see how the focus is kind of switching, but still I would say somewhat regional. But some of the things they were leveraging in their attacks is they're using a PDF for a spear phishing campaign, specifically target or using the Ministry of Justice as kind of the lure in their PDF. And as you open the PDF, it forces you to basically pull down a Java runtime, and then the jar file will basically pull down the rest of the net support components to get that net support rat implemented. What was really interesting to me, though, is they actually leveraged geofencing. So only their targets, when they would hit this lure and go to their malicious infrastructure, if they didn't come from the right geolocation based on IP address, then they would just get redirected to the legitimate site. So they would be none the wiser, right? Only the people targeted were actually getting sent the malicious route to get the jar and get this back door. So I thought that was really interesting as far as targeting goes. One, it kind of keeps your attack more or less on the low. And then if people will actually try to analyze things, so if you think about that too, maybe you get an email and your traditional process is to send things to a sandbox, see how it detonates and stuff like that. Well, geofencing is another mechanism that you don't necessarily see in the execution of whatever it is you're testing. It's more on the distant end. So even a sandbox wouldn't be able to tell you that that was going on. So it's a great sandbox avoidance, because if you look at a lot of malware that runs, you know, they'll have all these YARA rules and potential MITRE techniques associated with how it's avoiding a sandbox, and that's how they know it's malicious. So the geofencing thing was a good step from their perspective. But the other thing, you know, is interesting is they were very aggressive about kind of their information collection. I think they had like 150 different processes they were looking to monitor and discover to figure out what kind of tools are being leveraged and stuff like that, which, you know, says a lot about, it's kind of the precursor to potentially building capabilities. So it's collecting information to build out capabilities. It could be collecting information for a follow-on type of attack that actually has, I guess, more impact or, you know, higher level of success in that regard. And then the part that stood out to me a lot was just their level of persistence, because they basically made net support, that admin remote admin tool, persist in three different ways. They had the startup directory where they dropped a bat file that would run. They also did the registry run key. And then they also created a scheduled task. And I always find that interesting. And I think it's only because, you know, typically we look for those different things. And so I feel like you're making a lot of noise. So you might be kind of showing your hand. But I also know that depending on the level of analysts or the person responding, especially when you're in that like alert fatigue, let's move things. If you find something and you think that's the only place because it was the first thing that came across your board or the only thing that you dug into, you might see that one thing, think you dealt with it, and then there's other levels of persistence that kind of follow, so you don't really fully remove that persistence. So that part I thought was interesting. And also, I think, you know, easy to identify. It's if you can ever see multiple points of persistence or things that you've definitely learned to hunt for persistence and have detections on persistence, and a lot of the persistence pieces are pointing to the same paths and especially executables, that's kind of suspicious on the same host in a lot of ways. So that usually in itself can almost be its own detection if you're able to do those types of correlations, I think. But yeah, so, you know, they have a lot of capabilities as far as how they're basically, you know, collecting data and stuff like that. But the big thing was just how they dropped a legitimate tool, how they were doing their targeting and the geofencing piece. But when it comes to a lot of the activities they're performing after the fact, other than like some of the data collection and some network pieces, it was really about the persistence. Once again, I always focus on persistence because it seems like it's, I mean, the same things across most campaigns. So it's a great place to start. So I don't know what you were able to pull out of this specifically. This stood out to you.
Yeah, I mean, the persistent thing is interesting. So we're always going to harp on it. It's crazy how often we see the same techniques used, right? They're such a large percent. Like these should be mainstay targets for your hunting, or if you're, you know, you're in an environment that can leverage them for detections. But Let me ask you this. If you were to track yourself back as an analyst, let's say you're in an analyst seat and you're looking for stuff. You're like, hey, I want to see if anybody's, you know, edited the Windows current version run key or something like that. You start there and let's say you get a hit on that one. What would make you pivot to these other two without intelligence here to tell you that they're connected? What would ever make you as an analyst necessarily start to dig at these other two pieces of persistence versus trying to find what it's done?
Yeah. So that's where I think the best pivot is if you identify on a host machine where persistence is launching something, is whatever that is that's being launched, look at other parents of that thing. And sometimes you might stumble across, well, okay, since it's a registry run key, Explorer runs that one. And then you'll see a scheduled task. And so you'll see SVC host, or you'll see something else running it, or services. And so you might see multiple instances, like that occur. But yeah, I think experience kind of goes a long way to just know, hey, and then, you know, I guess in the past, let's be honest, we probably didn't worry about that as much because it was just like a reimage problem, right? Like here's like, I found something bad, we're going to reimage it. So any other things that are there would probably be handled, right? But I do feel like with this bring your own device to work kind of stuff, or, you know, where people are working out of and things, that reimaging isn't always the step anymore, and depending on what's being touched or hit. So, you know, there's more of a risk there. But yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of why I try to put myself in that young analyst seat, and it's very easy for me to be like, okay, yeah. And same thing, if I were to look for those specific points of persistence and I've never looked before, that's why I think it's a great threat hunting thing. I would probably see enough false positives or enough data that I wouldn't know how to sort through, that I would be like, well, I mean, this is obviously good for persistence, but it's not a good thing to detect on, which is false. You just need to know how to manage your data, understand parts of your data, and know how to exclude certain things. And knowing your tooling and experience helps with that, and goes a long way.
Yeah, I can think about like historically some of the experiences I had. Like when you see or catch one of these, you're generally not looking for the other three. Like there's just not that. At least for me, at least from the path that I came up, you know, there's not this protocol of, okay, go look for the other persistence layers. So it's kind of brilliant that they do this because they're giving themselves three times the chance to stay persistent.
Yeah, and depending on, you know, who responds and that they know who responds and the cost it takes to reimage machine and downtime, maybe they know that that's why it's super viable for their targets.
And not to sound crazy here, but when I hear that whole just, oh, we found something that set itself in the Windows current version run key, and it looks like it's persistence established. Just reimage it. And then I'm like, you said reimage it? Like, what about the other stuff? Oh, it's fine. Just reimage it and put it back in. And I know that comes down to like different environments and business risk and all that, but man, it all stressed me crazy.
The other thing I failed to mention is the jar files that they used were not obfuscated in any way or encrypted. And that was interesting too, because it's almost like they expect people, if they were to look at the jar, if it looked all weird, maybe they'd be suspicious, but because it doesn't look all weird, it maybe looks more authentic.
Yeah.
Like there's some decisions they made, right? That I don't know if they were, you know, specifically intentional, but they're interesting. And so they kind of walk through some of the stuff in the jars, and the fact they're using jars, yeah, Java is something easy to run everywhere as long as you have a Java run time environment. And I'm not sure how many security tools dig into jars, you know what I mean? So that might be another thing as well.
Yeah, some similar with the node stuff. Like that's a good reason, because they're not being inspected, right? In a lot of cases. Right.
Yep.
Very cool.
All right. What do you got now?
So the second one I have today is from ESET. It's titled Muddy Water Sneaks by the Riverbank. So the cyber espionage group Muddy Water, also known as Mango Sandstorm or TA-450, has launched a new campaign targeting critical infrastructure, primarily in Israel, with a confirmed victim in Egypt as well. In this campaign, Muddy Water used a refined and stealthy tool set, including a custom loader disguised again as a benign game to drop and execute a previously undocumented backdoor. So the core tradecraft shows a deliberate evolution. Rather than using noisy interactive hands-on keyboard operations, the group has begun to favor automation, memory-only payload loading, and less conspicuous credential browser data exfil. The primary goal appears to be espionage, maintain covert access to compromised networks, harvest credentials, browser data, routine execution of commands, and then continuously exfiltrate that information, trying to avoid detection and trying to leave as little artifacts as possible. So some of the technical pieces about this. So the first piece is the loader. It's dubbed Fooder. Maybe I'm saying that right. Maybe I'm not. It's a word that my brain is having a hard time with. It's a 64-bit C++ loader used to decrypt and reflectively load embedded payloads directly into memory. So no need to write the backdoor to disk. Multiple Fooder variants masqueraded as a benign classic snake game. The loader employs a custom delay function, pretty much mimicking the snake game's like loop plus sleep API calls, likely to what at least it seems to be likely to kind of like avoid or aggravate or just make sandboxing or automated analysis difficult. So the backdoor, once it's there, is called Muddy Viper. Previously undocumented, again, written in C++, once loaded into memory by Fooder, it enables execution of shell commands or arbitrary binaries, file upload, download, reverse shell, stealing Windows credentials and browser data, enumeration of, it also does enumeration of installed security tools, like different security tools, AV tools, things like that. It actually carries a hard-coded list of 150 process names or 150 plus process names. To kind of check, and then it'll send verbose environment reports to the C2, likely for reconnaissance. Persistence, again, another theme, all three so far. Persistence via that the startup folder and the run registry, and also scheduled tasks. And it does have self-uninstall capabilities. So there are some supporting tool sets in this that were interesting and also add to the kind of what we could potentially hunt for. So they have a tool set called CE-Notes, which is a browser data stealer. It's capable of extracting cookie credentials from Chromium family browsers by decrypting that app-bound encryption key from the local state. The LP-Notes tool set is also a credential stealer. This one actually shows and pops up a fake Windows security dialog to fish credentials. It's more traditional, but it looks pretty convincing. And it does use obfuscation and dynamic API resolution to complicate the static analysis of that piece as well. There's a Go-Sox5 reverse tunnel toolset that they're leveraging. It's used to bypass firewall, aid in stealthy network communication, lateral movement, exfil, things like that. And then another one is called the Blub browser data stealer. Blub is a C++ browser data stealer incorporating a statically linked SQLite library. So this is used and done on the system to negate the DP API. It also has built-in checks that look for running processes associated with security solutions. So multiple facets in this whole toolbox here. From the C2 side, Muddy Viper communicates over HTTPS, but it does something kind of interesting. So I'm curious what you think on this one, Scott. It uses HTTP GET requests with encrypted payloads. It seems kind of unusual in that data is often included in the request bodies. So, but the communications are encrypted using AES CBC via the Windows new CNG API. So something there that we'll circle back to. A couple things that I pulled out there. Again, there were some easy low-hanging things here when you can think about hunting for this specific type of activity. You see in this, you know, again, PowerShell down leveraging PowerShell to download files, encoded commands, that kind of unusual use of WinHTTP over port 443 with a non-standard user agent. So Muddy Viper actually leveraged the user agent called a WinHTTP example program /1.0. So it might rub some people the wrong way when we talk about investigating or looking at user agents, but there can be some oddities that form there. And this was evidence of one of those, I thought. That HTTP GET request instead of using POST. I thought that was interesting. Then you can track, we've talked about this, I think a few weeks back, maybe a month or so ago, considering the SOX reverse tunnels, SOX proxies, looking for communications that are kind of flowing through those avenues. The creation of scheduled tasks, startup folder entries, and register run key modifications. Those are the theme of the day. And then another one that was there for the browser stealer. So there were multiple browser stealers. Two of them were could specifically target Chrome. So as an example, there are things you can look for to track that. One being something that's not the browser itself accessing the browser credential stores. So when you're looking for that, like, you know, down your Google directory into that local state area, if you see something that's not the browser accessing that should be a red flag pretty quickly. And then also they have had Muddy Water has historically had and leveraged the use of remote management tools at variant different portions. It was also mentioned in this one. A couple of the tools that they have historically used, even in recent time, Action One's one, and then PDQ is another one. I'm somewhat familiar with Action One a bit. PDQ, that one doesn't strike anything. Also, yeah. Scott, I don't know if you know this or not, but does it feel like every time we talk about remote management tools, there's five new ones that get dropped in front of your face? I feel like that's always the case.
Yeah, I feel like there's like the one you've heard of, and then there's like two or three you're like, huh. And then the next week we'll like touch on the two or three we heard of, and then they'll be like one. It just seems like it's a revolving door, and
yep.
and then you haven't heard of one in a while, and then it's being used again. So it's almost like It's not like it ever completely falls off.
But yeah, I mean, this one, this was interesting. I thought there was some stuff that's there that's low hanging. There was a couple interesting stuff with the depth and the variety of tools that they had packaged in what they were trying to accomplish here. But I'm curious what you thought about it all, Scott.
Yeah, there are a couple interesting things. One, when they were using the CE notes, right, the fact that they were actually using PowerShell to do a web request and then pipe that to the invoke expression, which basically means, hey, download this and run it. That's usually not a good behavior. You also see traffic going directly to an IP because that's the URL. It's HTTP, not HTTPS. So it's even more like that quick infrastructure setup stuff. And then obviously the invoke expression. And I think this is also where it's important to understand aliases. They didn't use any aliases in the example they showed here, but there's many ways to call this and use multitude of aliases for invoke expression as well as web request. Or invoke web requests. So something when you're hunting, you should keep that in mind. The other thing that I haven't seen in a long time, because I want to say this is something I saw early on as an analyst when I was just kind of learning about the tech behaviors and techniques and things. And it wasn't that they specifically used the startup directory. It's they changed the registry entry to change the startup directory to where the malware is installed. And what's interesting about that is, one, it's a key a lot of people probably don't monitor. And two, it's in the user hive. So as long as you have access as the user, right, you're able to run things, you can change those registry hives all day. So anytime that user logs in, it will launch that malware. And so it's in the current version Explorer user shell folders /startup. You can put the path there. And you only can have one startup folder for Windows, but something that could be interestingly done is you could potentially put something there that will then run and then run things in the real startup folder if you're like trying to hide it more. So you can kind of do like this chain effect. I don't think they did that here, but as I was looking into that about like what are some of the things people have tried, because I haven't seen this technique in so long. But it's a good thing to pay attention to because it is a little out of the ordinary. But trying to leverage the same, behavior with startup folder behavior. And then obviously the scheduled task thing, right? That just seems like, I feel like if someone can get persistence, scheduled tasks is a great way to elevate and get your tasks to run at a higher privilege versus the other pieces just to make sure you have persistence. So yeah, those are the big things for me.
Very cool. Well, what's the last item for today, Scott?
Yeah, so this is kind of just stood out because, one, I kind of forgotten about it a little bit. And then when I was reading this one article, it also stood out to me as a little weird. But I originally stumbled across this Fortinet blog, and it's talking about the Shadow V2. It's called Shadow V2 Casts a Shadow Over IoT Devices. And so, first off, Shadow V2 kind of emerged, and I remember reading about it. And this was, I wouldn't say emerging, but it was, you know, September of this year. And it was really targeting vulnerable Docker instances in AWS and taking over things there by being able to pull down an image, and then it would have like a Go rat or something like that. And it had the typical things you'd see from a botnet, where it was able to do HTTP floods, some sort of, you know, distributed denial of service, all that kind of stuff, right? And so they kind of talk through it in this Darktrace report that I'm kind of referencing here about those capabilities and how they did the whole, you know, exposing the Docker and doing those things at that time. But the Fortinet thing, what kind of caught me off guard was they kind of brought it up because it was, they started out with the end of the October during the global disruption of AWS connections. And in October, the disruption was a race condition with the DNS being updated to where it caused two different processes at different speeds. One was slow to update, while the other one removed the DNS entry for the entire AWS East region, or East One, I guess. So essentially, then there was this cascading effect because now blocks of stuff in AWS East couldn't route, and then all the services there couldn't route. So like, it kind of made, like we've seen with major services, the internet kind of dead. And so that's when it was interesting, because they, FortiGuard Lab said they observed the malware Shadow V2 spreading via IoT vulnerabilities. So it just shift, right? Then they said it was similar to the Mirai botnet based on the behaviors and the vulnerabilities and things it was going after. So obviously, one of the interesting things about the Shadow V2 when they were analyzing it before was there is a blacklist that kind of comes with this bot. And they were thinking that's a way where maybe the writer can actually do paid for services to essentially say, hey, if you pay me, then I'll make sure the bot can't attack you, which I thought was an interesting way to potentially leverage to make money on a botnet without actually having to use it, because the Mirai botnet can be pretty potent when it comes to denial services. But the other thing that kind of, like, why this stood out to me was they only saw the activity during the AWS outage, and then they kind of went away. And I'm assuming they're using IDS for this. And I was wondering, is it because were they able to see this activity only because when all the noise died down, there wasn't enough traffic to either overwhelm the sensor, or where things were getting dropped or something? Like, it felt like more of a visibility gap, because I can't imagine if there was a botnet, their whole goal is to scan and infect constantly, right? So if we're to do it once, unless they just happen to catch it in a time when it's development, but the oddity of where there was an outage of a big part of the internet where services just couldn't talk, so things were just kind of dead. And then all of a sudden you see this uptick of this other stuff because it's the only thing that was willing to talk, kind of thing, struck me as really odd. But they, you know, obviously it's very distributed as far as the countries of the devices it was trying to target. Yeah, I had a list here of the devices, but it's the common devices like your typical home-based routers, D-Link stuff, TP-Link stuff, the DDWRT, and, you know, is actually looking at really old vulnerabilities and stuff that goes, you know, as recent as 2024, which is, you know, to be completely honest, people don't update their stuff home that often. I don't know, you wouldn't even know to update your router unless you logged into it, I would think. And even then you might not even care to do it. So, you know, old vulnerabilities and things like that, are still, you know, viable. But yeah, that was the big thing that stood out to me, that I kind of just, you know, wondering what your thoughts on why they saw this activity during the AWS, kind of when they went dark, for instance. And also, I mean, if Shadow V2 is now adding on to the types of devices, it's going to be pretty competitive, especially against the Mirai botnet, but from a denial of service perspective, sounds like in the future it could be pretty devastating.
Yeah, a lot of footprint, right? No, I mean, I had a similar, I mean, my first thought instantly was it had to have been because the traffic was less.
Right.
Right. Like, I'm not trying to echo what you're saying, but that was my first thought. But like, that leads to the whole, like, okay, how do you find it when the traffic's not less? How does that stand out to you? Like, things learned to be able to detect and identify this kind of activity when the noise is there, if that was the case, right? It could also be that there was less to look at, not necessarily the traffic, so more eyes were able to hit it to discover it. You know, we could speculate,
right? Like, I could feel like it could be eyes, because we're talking about like commercial home stuff. It could be a priority where like the alert is just so low level that, and then maybe based on priority, if there's so much data in the pipe that it gets dropped, because, you know, like, who knows? But I guess the point I really wanted to highlight is, like, this is a good example when you think about security operations on, when you get hyper focused on some things, you might miss other things. And you got to figure out how to manage that, and also how to, have the curiosity to every once in a while, just kind of explore the thing you think is kind of dumb, right? Potentially, or might not have good return, just to, you know, make sure that there's nothing new to catch or whatever. So I guess it's more like a lessons learned from, I guess, a potential opinion I have about the article, because the scenario was interesting to me.
No, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you talking about that ops like that, man, it's hard to find the right balance for the net you're going to cast, right? We've experienced that time and time again. We're like, man, we'd really like to chase this down. This would be really cool. We could potentially innovate on this idea. And, you know, it doesn't take priority because X, Y, or Z reasons. So you get that higher focus and, you know, all the things. But yeah. Oh, this is interesting. This is a good one, Scott.
Yeah. So hopefully it also creates some food for thought for others. But yeah, that kind of closes out what I think we're going to talk about this week. So I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of December 1st, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.